Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Today's Morning Philip at the Garage in Rapid City featured a conversation on civility and politics with Greg LaBelle. He's the director of the Semester in Washington Politics Program at George Washington University. He's assistant professor of political management and also directs the university's Native American Political Leadership Program. His campaign experience includes work on the presidential campaign of George McGovern. Greg LaBelle joins us now from our studios in Rapid City. Sir, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So let's start with what's changed in presidential political messaging over the years. And I'm asking because I spent a lot of time listening to the Hamilton musical soundtrack this week. And Jefferson and Hamilton are trash-talking each other. What's changed over the years, though, in how we have conversations about politics?
Well, I guess historically, trash talking has been part of American politics since those first rounds. I think that what's making the difference now in the 21st century is a couple of things. I think that the changes in media, particularly social media, have increased the impact of these things. Have increased probably the nastiness of these things too, in a way. So that's a sort of a significant difference that that we see. I think the other change is that we are, as a society, I think we are more and more sort of separating ourselves from each other and clinging to people who think like us. And I think that has enhanced the nastiness of campaign rhetoric that we've seen in the last few years.
What's the role? You said media and social media are really close to each other, but they're two different things, aren't
they? Yes, they are. Social media, I think, has really had the major impact. It's funny, when social media came into existence a number of years ago, we really thought that it was going to be the place where there was more civil dialogue, and the opposite seems to have been the case. There is much more vitriol that's presented there than shows up in almost any other means of political communication today.
So we have issues to talk about that are important in this country. We have, you know, conversations that really matter and become contentious. How do you approach the really tough stuff in a way that's healthy, a healthy dialogue that can move forward toward a compromise?
Well, this sounds sort of naive, I think, but it is about listening. It's about hearing. It's hearing what the other side says, and I think again the nature of political communication mitigates against that sort of approach today. The 6 second soundbite, the preponderance of short, 30 second media spots, and so on and so forth, I think cuts into our ability to have those reasoned conversations. And you know, and in addition, I think it's the demand or the search on the part of the media for their share of eyeballs and so on and so forth, and clicks on what's going on. So all of this, I think, results in an increased level of or decreased level of seriousness of debate.
So what about when the person I'm listening to says something I don't like, or says something that's clearly racist, or something that's seems to the listener to be, what do you do then?
Well, it's interesting because this is an ongoing challenge. Several years ago, when I was working in an organization in Washington called the Interfaith Alliance, this was around the time of the Clinton impeachment. We did a series of discussions around the country on the issue of civility in politics, and it was really interesting to hear the different viewpoints, because I think while people generally think that civility in politics is important in discussing issues and so forth, when they get to those issues that really matter to them, there suddenly the attitude sort of changes a little bit. And I think that we need to find ways to talk about things like racism and other issues that allow us to call people on it without engaging in name calling, because we sort of put ourselves in the same position as the folks we're trying to talk to.
How much of the polarization in this country is systemic? It's part of a two-party system, and sort of how we have conversations around an election based on that two-party system. How much of the polarization comes from that?
I think the polarization is more recent than the two-party system. And I think it has to do in part with the divisions that we now see within the parties. We have, in the 70s and 80s, we essentially had two Democratic parties struggling to sort of figure out what the Democratic Party was going to be. And it was actually Bill Clinton as a presidential candidate who came in and I think was able to pull those factions of the party together with some success. The Republican Party is struggling with that right now. There are serious internal divisions. It's even been going on for a while. I think that for the last few cycles, the Republican Party is struggling at the presidential level, especially with, you know, what should the party be? Should the party be beholden to the religious right and sort of pure in its approach to issues? Or should it be trying to find a place a little bit more toward the middle and appeal to more voters? And this is a serious debate that's been going on. We add in the rise of the Tea Party, which originally was a little different from the Christian right. It was much more economically based, and so on and so forth. So there are these struggles that go on within the parties that I think exacerbate this kind of problem.
Did you see that with the Democrats and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's? It didn't seem like unified. The Democrats going into their convention were also really striving for party unity and were not finding it those first few days.
They were not finding it those first few days. I think they were fairly successful at bringing it about over time. In fact, I was sort of amazed at how they were able to bring about a change in that sense. But, you know, I think that this gets to a deeper challenge within the country. I think we know that there is a sense of alienation, a sense of powerlessness out there, a sense of not being heard. And to a large extent, I think the genesis of the Bernie Sanders movement and the genesis of the Donald Trump movement really come from that same place. Now, obviously, these are two candidates who handle these issues very differently, with very different proposals. But that sense of not being heard, I think, is a lot of what powered both of these candidacies. Bernie's fell short, and obviously Donald Trump's. So certainly, in terms of the nomination, did not. But there are similar factors at play here, and I think that we need to listen and hear these people and hear what it is that they're trying to tell us about their relationship to the political process.
Because even if their candidate goes away, the voters don't. Even if their candidate loses, the voters are still there with some of those same concerns, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then the question becomes, what do they do with that? Now, I think the Sanders thing was interesting because when Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton, there was a serious backlash against Senator Sanders at the convention, not so much on the floor, but outside the convention hall. Sanders was booed by his own supporters after he endorsed Secretary Clinton. So the question is sort of, where do those folks go? Where does that energy land? Does it sort of dissipate? Do people sort of stay away from the polls, say a pox on both your houses, I'm done with this process? And I think there was certainly a sense of that among some of the Sanders supporters at the Democratic convention. Or do they find another place to go? Do they go to one of the third or fourth party? Or do they quietly sort of get in line and end up supporting the nominee? I think we're going to see a little bit of all of those in this cycle.
You have taught ethics and spoken about ethics. You've taught ethics at a graduate level. When people are talking about Hillary Clinton and saying what they dislike about her, or even her supporters, they're challenged by the email scandal that she's had. They're challenged by Benghazi. Some of those things come back to the question of ethics. How do you address that when you look at a campaign like Hillary Clinton's?
Well, I think one has to take that head on and recognize that I think particularly around the issue of the emails, there are some ethical questions that come up there. What was the intent, and how did it sort of play itself out? And then how did Clinton handle this? I think in addition to the ethical question, there is just the
if you will, the tactical question here, because I think, and this is sort of a part of, I think, Hillary Clinton's history. There is an attempt always when issues like this come up to sort of ignore them, minimize them, tuck them away, and sort of try not to talk about them, which I think usually makes the situation worse. And I think we've seen that happen with this situation with emails.
How big is the disconnect between those who serve us in Washington and the voters today?
Oh, I think it's for a lot of people, it's significant. There is that widespread sense, as I said, that the people are not being heard, and I think a good deal of it is legitimate. I think there are other factors that sort of come into play with this as well, and I think that has to do with the way this country is changing demographically. There is a great deal of concern among people. Particularly white men in this country who see themselves, who see a country that's heading in a direction that they don't understand and maybe don't feel all that comfortable with in terms of diversity and so on and so forth. So there are a number of factors that come into play here. But we need to be thinking about and looking at all of those factors and figuring out how we address them as a society.
So let's talk a little bit about white men more. I know it's somewhat of a metaphor, but I mean, you do hear that among some of the voters and what they're saying. And they're saying what exactly? What are you hearing white male voters say, and how can that be addressed?
Well, I think you need to look at particularly the white male voters without college educations. I think it's fair to say that many of these folks have not felt the effects of the recovery that we've seen since the collapse of the economy in 2008. And so there's a great deal of resentment there. But I think this predates this. I think that as a society, as we've seen women take on more prominent roles in public life, as we've seen African Americans and Hispanics become more significant players in politics, and obviously including the president of Barack Obama, we've seen progress on issues like marriage equality. I think there are people in this country who are distressed by this, and I'm not even sure that they can articulate it, but it's they sense a broadening of power beyond what they're used to having. But it's not really a new phenomenon. It's just I think there are a number of things that have sort of aggravated that sense in the future. And I think that what's happened is Donald Trump has provided a voice for that frustration and anger among these people with even his slogan, Make America Great Again. But certainly in some of the language he's used in talking about minorities and other groups in this country, I think people are hearing that as a validation of their concerns and frustrations.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with this morning's Morning Philip guest from Rapid City at the Garage. His name is Greg LaBelle. He's an assistant professor of political management, director of the semester in Washington program at George Washington University. Sorry to mess it up a little bit there. I was doing some research online, and you were talking a few years back about Mitt Romney's campaign and how he had trouble staying on message. So Donald Trump's ability to stay on message must give you something to talk about.
Donald Trump makes Mitt Romney look like the perfect message candidate. Yeah, the Trump phenomenon is an interesting one, and I think most of us are sort of struggling to try to figure out exactly what it is and what it means, because this is a guy who clearly is most comfortable speaking off the cuff. When he tries to put himself in a situation where he's scripted, he's obviously uncomfortable. This worked during the primary process. Obviously, he ended up with the nomination. I think there are some reasons why it worked in the Republican nomination process that make it a little bit more, or maybe considerably more, difficult for him now in the general election. But this is not a guy who believes that there are folks who can tell him very much about how he should be approaching these issues or this messaging.
I want to make sure before we run out of time to ask you about the Native American Political Leadership Program. I know it's important to you. Give us an overview of that program and how people from South Dakota can benefit from it.
Sure, I appreciate that. Yeah, the Native American Political Leadership Program is a full scholarship program that we created 10 years ago to provide full scholarship funding for Native American, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian students to come to Washington and participate in the larger semester in Washington politics program, where they come to Washington, they do coursework with us for college credit to transfer back to their institutions. They do professional internships in Washington on the Hill and with advocacy groups, and the administration and other places. We do networking events where they get an opportunity to get into the city and meet and talk with folks who they wouldn't ordinarily have an opportunity to chat with it just coming into the city as tourists. And it's been an important program for us at the university, and we've seen close to 200 students come through the program since its inception. We had the opportunity to take them to the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, and watching them sort of engage in that process was really very exciting, and they were very excited about having the opportunity to do there. We an outgrowth of that is the Inspire Native Teens program, which brings 10 high school Native students into Washington for a 3-week intensive program in the summer. At the end of which they have earned 3 college credits that they can then take with them as they begin to look at their college careers beyond high school.
Tell us how people can find out more about that and being involved in it.
Probably the best way is to go to the website, which is naplp.gwu.edu. All the information that they would need would be there. And the Inspire program is listed under that as well.
We will put a link up to that on our website after the show at sdpb.org/Dakota Midday. Greg LaBelle, thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for coming to South Dakota.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.